the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Jeff Gwynn is my guest. He is the author of Go Down Together, The True Untold Story of Bonnie and Clyde, and The Last Gunfight, The Real Story of the Shootout at the OK Corral and How It Changed the American West. His latest book is Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson. Jeff Gwynn, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much.
Here's what I was thinking about when I was reading Manson. On 9/11, a bunch of men flew planes into buildings, and of course, they died doing that terrible thing. And hundreds of people drank poisonous Kool-Aid after giving it to their children in Jonestown. And the Nazis, you know, with the consent of the German people, they killed millions of people. How does it happen that a person can make other people or convince other people to do insanely terrible things?
Well, it's sad, but it's a constant in our history that there have always been certain individuals who understand human nature enough and know how to pick out just the right people and more or less take them over. In almost every case, including the ones you're discussing, this person would take his disciples and try to isolate them as much as possible so he could bend them to his will. That's what Manson did, on a smaller scale, certainly, than Jim Jones or the Nazis or Al-Qaeda. But still, it's a pertinent example of the way people can, without really realizing they're being coerced, be led into these awful kinds of things.
Do you think if Manson had been someone else, I mean, and had more benevolent or, you know, a positive ideas, that he still would have had this effect on people? Do you think that it's the dark side of the force that keeps people involved?
Well, one of the things that really bothered me in the 3 years that I was researching and writing this book, I'm 62 years old, and by the time you get to this age, you have some beliefs that you've more or less developed over the course of your life, and you know, you try to live according to these concepts. I had never believed before I started writing this book that anyone was beyond redemption, that it might really be possible to be born bad and simply get worse during your life. But that, if that's true, Charles Manson is Exhibit A. There was never anything good about him, and in all these years and talking to people who had known him at every stage of his life, there was never anyone who could remember one cute or sweet thing Manson did as a child or something generous that he did for a friend or a stranger when he was an adult. The horrific sort of things that he did, that was almost inevitable. No matter what place or time Charles Manson had been born and lived in, I think he would have been a really evil person, and he would have done his best to lead others into committing horrific acts.
That's kind of sad, isn't it?
It is sad, and it bothers me. I don't want to believe it, and I'm not sure I entirely do, but the whole experience of researching writing this book has made me aware of things I didn't know before, and now I wish I didn't know them.
There was a woman, her name was Mae Brussel, and she lived here in this area, and she was an conspiracies. She was a conspiracy theorist, I guess you'd say. Since you're in Fort Worth, Texas, people have been talking about conspiracies there for the last 50 years.
Oh, yes.
Well, she, at one point in her theory, said that she thought that the Manson case, and that Manson himself was part of a conspiracy to discredit the youth movement and to discredit the Beatles by, you know, making the hippie movement into something dark and terrible.
If you only knew about the acts that Manson's followers committed on August 9th and 10th in 1969, and if you only knew the publicity that followed that, I can see why, if you were the sort of person who would see conspiracies everywhere, you might decide, well, there's another one. But if you follow Charles Manson's complete life, and that's something I wanted to do in this book because it hadn't been done before, really see him in the context of his whole life, not just those couple events that made him infamous, you can see that the things Manson was doing simply escalated from year to year to year. Back in McMicken, West Virginia, when he's in first grade, he's already attacking his cousin with a sickle that he picks up in the backyard. He's already talking girls in his class into beating up a boy he doesn't like, then claiming afterward it was what they wanted to do. Don't blame him for it. There was no conspiracy. It was the devastating truth, and it's really hard to accept, is that Charles Manson throughout his life was the wrong man in the right place in the right time. And he just happened to have the skills necessary in the late 1960s to find a bunch of somewhat addled, certainly confused young people and convince them that they should follow him and do whatever he said. There was no conspiracy, though. Lord knows he was a godsend for Richard Nixon and the conservatives who at that time were saying, well, the hippie movement is not only foolish and communist-inspired, but it's dangerous. No, there was no conspiracy. Sad as it is to accept, it was simply Charles Mills Manson.
Now, in the case, in the trial against Manson and the prosecution of Manson, the district attorney or assistant district attorney, Vincent Bugliosi, kind of shocked the world when he announced the motive, as he saw it, that the helter-skelter motive that Manson believed that there would be a revolution of, well, you can explain it better than I can, and I'm going to let you do that in a second. But what I'm asking is, did Manson truly believe this, or was he a con man and this was just one of his cons?
Vincent Bugliosi, during the time I was working on this book, could not have been more generous to me with his time, with his suggestions, being willing to talk over different things. And one of the first things I wanted to ask him about was, after all these years and all his interactions with Manson, did Vince believe that Manson thought there was going to be this apocalyptic racial event? And Mr. Bugliosi's answer was, no, not really. And from what I can come up with, and I've spent an awful lot of time interviewing some of the family members who were with Manson at this time, you've got to remember that this whole apocalyptic helter-skelter, that the Beatles and the Bible, speaking through Charlie, were predicting this devastating race war when the blacks in America would rise up and wipe out the whites. That was just one of the spiels Charlie was talking out there, and he used it as a tool to keep his followers loyal. He would tell them the race war was coming, and they had two choices. They could stay with Charlie and be protected, or they could go out on their own, the race war would come, and they'd either be slaughtered by the blacks or else turned into a slave to the blacks. That was another thing he said was going to happen. The surviving whites would be slaves to the blacks, and that would just be karma for the whites making black slaves for so many years. At the same time, he's also telling them that he's the second coming of Christ. He's also telling them that it's his fate to become one of the greatest rock and roll stars, if not the greatest rock and roll star in music history, even bigger than the Beatles. It was all part of the shuck and jive. It was all part of the act. At best, he might have hoped later on, in trying to make the Tate LaBianca murders appear to have been committed by black militants, no, that wasn't going to start a race war, but maybe in racially charged Los Angeles, it might be good for another riot. And if that happened, he can point out to his followers and say, see, I told you so. So it was part of the act, but not the complete act. Manson always knew what he was doing. It's always been a con.
We're talking with Jeff Gwynn, and his latest book is called Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson. Well, If that's the case, then what in the world, what sense did it make to murder Sharon Tate and her friends?
Again, history, and even the bloodiest, the most senseless acts in history, never occur in a vacuum. There's always things coming together at the same time. And we have to think about Charles Manson in early August 1969. He is a failure at everything he's tried. He has been turned down for a recording contract, not only by Terry Melcher, but a number of other music executives in Los Angeles. That dream is not coming true. A drug deal has gone bad. An associate of his, not a member of the family, but a close friend named Bobby Beausoleil, has murdered a music teacher named Gary Hinman as part of the bad drug deal. And Manson is terrified that Beausoleil is going to link Manson himself to the murders. And he's got these followers. He's been promising them all these great things were going to happen. The race war. Charlie is a rock star. It's not happening. And gurus have to constantly produce miracles to keep their followers loyal. So in ordering the murders, or shall we say strongly suggesting that the murders take place, and orchestrating them without most of his followers knowing what he was doing, Manson's setting them up for any number of things. If there's a race riot afterward, great. If the police happen to notice, as Manson hopes they would, that the same methods were used in the Tate and LaBianca murders as the Hinman murder, since Beausoleil's in jail, they'll have to let Bobby go. That could happen. That keeps Manson from being implicated in that murder. And at the very least, his followers have killed for him, and now that gives him an extra hold over them. So all these things sort of combined on those two terrible nights. It was a culmination. It wasn't a random act.
We're talking with Jeff Gwynn, and his book is called Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson. So now, according to your book, Manson did... or probably did commit at least one murder.
Shorty Shay.
Yeah, but he didn't actually commit these murders, and yet he was convicted of them.
Under California law, and I promise you Vincent Pugliosi made this point to me over and over again, if someone is an active conspirator in planning and carrying out murder, then he is just as guilty as the persons who plunged the knives into the victims. So, by law, Manson was guilty of murder, even if he hadn't himself laid a finger on another human being. And, of course, people remember Tate and LaBianca, when a total of 7 people died over 2 nights. But there was the Hinman murder prior to those. There was the Shorty Shay murder shortly afterwards. He was a ranch hand at Spahn Ranch who Manson thought was trying to maneuver to get the family moved out of there. And in the Shay murder, Manson actually did participate. He also tried to kill a black drug dealer named Lotsapapa and thought he had, only to find later on that he had wounded him instead.
So he thought he had committed murder. That might have played a role in his thinking, right?
Well, he bragged to the family how he had just shot down this big black guy, and I'm using the words black guy in place of what Manson routinely would use to describe African Americans.
Thank you for
and
doing that.
He used that during Tate LaBianca in the run-up to that to goad them. He was willing to kill to protect the family. Were they willing to do the same thing or not?
When in reality, as you were saying before, he wasn't really willing to do anything to protect the family. He just would do anything to keep the family.
Yes. Everything Charles Manson has done throughout his life has been for his own benefit. Again, he is not in any way crazy, but he is coldly calculating. And one of the things people forget is before he went out to recruit young people to be his family, to be his followers, he was trying to earn his living as a pimp, and he wasn't very good at that. Manson really didn't succeed at much in anything in life, except, unfortunately, getting together a group of young people, some of whom could be turned to commit murder for him. And I don't know if we should call that a success or a disaster.
Was he, I don't know, is he smart? Is he not so smart?
Well, because he's uneducated, people make the mistake of thinking Charles Manson must be stupid. He isn't. He's actually extremely bright. Even from his letters to me, he can't spell worth a darn. He has no sense of grammar. But in terms of being able to assimilate the ideas of others and present them as his own, I don't know that there's ever been anybody better. I mean, he not only cribbed from the Beatles and the Bible, but even back in prison, he was soaking up a course, Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. When I talked to Leslie Van Houten and Patricia Krenwinkel in their prisons in California, I said, my God, what could Charles Manson have said to you when you first met him that would make you think, this man understands me, I want to be with him, he's special? And they said, well, Charlie said this and this and this. Straight out of Chapter 7, How to Win Friends and Influence People, we're not talking about kind of like, we're talking about word for word. He did not have an original idea, but he didn't need to. He knew how to take the precepts of others and twist them for his own use. And it takes a really smart man to do that so effectively.
Well, Jeff Gwynn, now I want to know more about your conversations with these people. No, so you've corresponded with Manson. You haven't actually met him, but what he wrote you letters, you emailed. How'd that work?
Well, for 4 or 5 months, I actually sent Manson a letter a day asking for him to see me. And one day I finally heard from one of his current followers, and he has some, who said that Charles had turned my letters over to him, and clearly my letters indicated what a terrible person I was. This follower and I communicated for a while, and then one day I get a letter from Manson. It's not a pleasant letter.
It's a handwritten letter on paper?
Yes, it is. He didn't want me to write my book. He's got a great network out there, and he had an idea of some of the people I was talking to, and that meant certainly that I was going to be able to prove he had lied about many, many things, including his childhood. So the letter basically warned me off. But later, when I wanted to use some of his prison art in the book, and the lawyers at Simon & Schuster, my publisher, said I couldn't do that without written permission from the artist, he actually wrote a letter granting me permission. He likes to sell his prison art to fund some of his activities in jail. And I think probably he figured, if nothing else, my book might be good publicity for that.
If you were warned off by the Manson family, isn't there a part of you that took that pretty seriously and said maybe you shouldn't do this?
Well, a couple things. First of all, I was an investigative journalist for about 150 years. and one of the things you learn in that line of work is that you never have to really worry about the people who threaten you. So that wasn't necessarily a concern. And the second thing was, we tend to have this image of Manson as sort of all-powerful, and he can reach out even from a prison cell and do what he wants to do. He's 79 years old, turned 79 earlier this month. He has a few followers left. In fact, at the moment, he's one of them, a 25-year-old young woman, is claiming Charlie's going to marry her, and good luck for that. But these days, Charlie's followers, if they want to get you, tend to try to do it through Facebook messages or blasting your book on the Amazon reader comments. And frankly, I think I can live with that danger.
Well, I guess that's not life-threatening.
Well, it's not life-threatening. Again, one of the mistakes people make is they think, well, Manson can only pull in gullible, dumb people. In fact, a lot of highly intelligent people, beginning, I think, with Leslie Van Houten and continuing on down, fell for Charlie's line. He likes to call himself, or did back in those days, the man of a thousand hats. And he would brag to people that depending on who he was talking to, he could change his personality instantly to make them believe in him, to make them like him. That he would act one way with a motorcycle gang and another way with a college professor he was hoping would give some money and subsidize the family. So Manson's a chameleon. And what we think we see is entirely different from what some of these current followers think they see.
Now, you also talked to these women who were actually the ones who perpetrated the crime of murder.
Yep.
And what I mean, I know what I would ask them, so I don't know what you asked them. But I mean, what were they? Okay, here I'll ask you all the questions, and you can tell me. Were they on acid or stoned when they committed the crimes? What do they think now about what they did? What do they remember, and what are they willing to tell you about those crimes?
Well, let's sort of start in reverse order. Of the three women who were first sentenced to death for the Tate LaBianca murders and are now serving life sentences, only two have survived. Susan Atkins died of cancer a couple of years ago. But I had quite a few very long meetings at their prison individually with Leslie Van Houten and Patricia Krenwinkel, who are now women in their 60s and have spent pretty much 44 years in prison. They were kids when they went in, and now they're old ladies. Van Houten in particular, who was a very pretty popular girl in high school, still retains sort of the physical gestures that a popular high school kid would have. She giggles when she talks. She'll put her hand on your arm, play with her hair a little bit. It's like she's frozen in amber socially, that she never really had a chance to grow up. Yes, they both very much regret what they did. They do take full responsibility for it, though they feel people don't understand how persuasive Manson was. There were an awful lot of drugs, certainly, at Spahn Ranch with the family, LSD in particular, but meth was part of it too, and pot. They were high a lot of the time. In terms of the nights of murder, Van Houten was just coming up for another parole hearing the four times I went to California to see her. So our agreement was that we would talk about everything. She would answer all my questions except for the second night, the LaBianca murders. She didn't want to say something to me about those murders and then inadvertently contradict that in the parole board hearings. Krenwinkel, however, said she would talk to me about everything, and she did, and as you can imagine, it was horrifying. But we learned a lot about the murders, particularly from Krenwinkel, who has never, ever talked in any detail about what happened those nights. She walked me through it. Then I would have to go back to my motel room and type it into my laptop, and after that I would have to try to sleep. And I didn't have much luck sleeping those several nights.
Well, it is chilling, and also the way things happen in your book, Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson, Jeff Gwynn, they happen, you know, everything happens with the same amount of, you write it just forthrightly. It's not suddenly there's chilling music playing and we're going to get to the murder. It's like, okay, they did this, they did this, they did this, they murdered these people and they did this and they did this. You know what I mean?
Well, again, what I'm trying to show in my book, when I decided I wanted to write about Charles Manson, what I really wanted to write about was America in the late 1960s. And probably you're not old enough to actually remember much about it.
Well, I am, actually.
Well, then you know. We were right there in the middle of it. It was a chaotic, unique time in our history. And the things happening then made it possible for someone like Charles Manson to emerge for a while, make his followers do what they did, and then make himself famous as a result, which is the thing Charlie always wanted most, to be famous. When you've got the facts, when you've got a lot of information that hasn't been out there before, then I think it's the job of the historian not to pretty things up or try to write salaciously or in a sensationalist manner. Instead, what I'm trying to do is put the puzzle pieces together for the readers and help them understand the course of the events that led up to this and, of course, the things that happened afterwards. Something Leslie Van Houten told me that Manson said to her and the family impressed me and scared me more than anything else, and I wonder if I can share that with you.
Please do.
Just before the final arrests out in Death Valley, when everything was closing in on Manson, Leslie Van Houten told me this, and then later in a separate interview, Patricia Krenwinkel told me this. And by the way, even though they're in the same prison, they are not best friends. They sort of nod to each other in passing, like people you knew in high school but sort of grew apart from in the years since. And they both told me this story. Manson calls together the remaining members of the family. They are literally starving out there in the desert. They've got some rice, some powdered milk, and a little cinnamon. That's what they're living on. And Manson says to them, if he's ever arrested again, he's going to put on his crazy Charlie act and keep it up as long as he has to, until the people who arrested him decide he's insane, can't be held accountable for whatever he might have done, and let him go. But he also warns them, when you see me that way, don't believe it. It is just an act. And what we have seen of Charles Manson in all these years since is the crazy Charlie act. He's doing it for effect, and he's doing it very well. He's kept up this role for 44 years and shows no sign of stopping. That proves how coldly calculating he is. And to me, that's even more horrifying than if he were a lunatic who was ordering, you know, the slaughter back in 1969. He knew exactly what he was doing, and that makes him even worse.
Well, all of the defendants were sentenced to death, and then in 1972, the Supreme Court said that the death penalty was cruel and unusual punishment, and so all of their sentences were converted or whatever to life without parole. Is that, or is it just life? Do they have possibility of parole?
Oh, yeah, they do, and some of Manson's parole hearings have been some of the greatest performances you've ever seen. Again, if he had been executed as originally scheduled, I think that might have gone a long way to making him less a long-term icon. And, of course, Helter Skelter, the fabulous book by Vincent Bugliosi and Kurt Gentry, was such a sensation. So you have Charlie living instead of being executed. You have the book Helter Skelter. You have Squeaky Fromm's failed attempt to assassinate Gerald Ford. So these things stamp Manson in our cultural consciousness, and then periodically he picks his spots to pop up on Geraldo or whatever and put on some crazy act that gets people talking about him again. And just the latest news about him, which came last week, again is a perfect example of Manson sort of taking over the play when he can. My book's just come out. It's gotten an awful lot of attention, and it proves how much Manson has lied about his background and just about everything else. Then you get a very good Rolling Stone contributing editor who's going in to interview Manson and to write about Manson's life in prison today and to capture, I think, quite well in the story, just what a manipulator Manson is. So you've got all these things that would sort of go against the image Charlie wants, and then all he does is have one of his young followers blithely announce that they're going to get married, and that's all anybody's talking about with Charlie Manson all of a sudden. The man understands how to manipulate the media. It's a gift, and he's got it.
Well, it's a fascinating book and incredibly well written, and I recommend it. It's called Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson. And the author is my guest, Jeff Gwynn. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, you can check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can also find us on Facebook, and you can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes. I want to thank Jeff Gwynn. His book is called Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.